The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. With the second anniversary tomorrow of the murder of George Floyd and the publication of His Name is George Floyd by Robert Samuels, a national political enterprise reporter for the Washington Post, and Tolu Olurunipa, a political enterprise and investigations reporter for the Post, they bring us the man in full behind the images of the martyr and situate George Floyd's life in the grand sweep of our country's history of racist policies and behaviors. Ibram X. Kendi calls the book essential for our times. Henry Louis Gates Jr. describes it as a chronicle of the racial awakening, essential history. Tonight, they'll be in conversation with Benjamin Todd Jealous, the current president of the People for the American Way, a teacher of social innovation at the University of Pennsylvania, and the former national president and CEO of the NAACP. Please welcome Robert Samuels, Tolu Olurunipa, and Ben Jealous to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
I just want to say, if anybody ever doubted that some of the greatest risks that any of us as Americans have to run the gauntlet of are shaped by policy, these massacres in the last couple weeks are a stark reminder. Let us, you know, all, of course, keep these 14 children who were murdered in our hearts and prayers, but let us also resolve to do what we must do to make sure that no American children have to grow up yoked by policies that are ultimately a risk to their lives. And that tonight is the conversation that we're going to have. Not an American child who grew up very much yoked by policies, allowed his life to be taken unnecessarily. I want to thank the authors for their work and introduce them. Briefly, I know they've been introduced already, but Robert Samuels and Tolu Olurunipa, writers at the Washington Post, took leave from their time as reporters covering politics and policy to really dig into, pardon my language, what the hell happened? How is this possible? In the land of the free, in the home of the brave, in this century, not some other century, how is this possible? So gentlemen, talk to me, please, about why. Like, why did you write this book? Why did you have great careers? Why did you, feel the need to dig into this in this way?
First, thanks for having us. We're really excited to be here and talk about what we learned over more than a year of researching George Floyd's life and his America. One of the things that led us to write this book was watching part of the video in which he died. I couldn't watch the full video. I had to hit pause right after I saw it in the summer of 2020. But I knew, especially as it became a viral moment, as people took to the streets, that this was going to be something that changed America. This was going to be a moment of history, and we're journalists. We write the first draft of history, but we wanted to go deeper than that. We wanted to explore the America that George Floyd knew long before he met Derek Chauvin, and it was important for us to investigate that part of our country's history, to acknowledge that part of our country's history, to write about the country that George Floyd knew, which is a very different country than many of us know, and it's a country that often gets ignored. It's a country that gets driven past on flyover roads and gets neglected as kids get taken out of schools. And it's a country that millions of people still live in. And it was important for us to grapple with that part of our history. It was important for us to research the life that George Floyd lived and not reduce him to a symbol, not reduce him to a mural, not reduce him to the movement that took place after his life, but focus on the life that he lived, the legacy that he leaves behind, the country that he left behind, the country that he strived in, the country in which he lived and died. It's important for us as journalists, as people who focus on policy, as people who want to be able to describe how policies impact real people and not have it just be, you know, political fights over what's happening or who's in power, but the real impact of these battles over power and policy. We could show it through George Floyd's life. We saw, as we investigated a number of these policies, and we can talk about it tonight, from housing to education to healthcare to criminal justice, of course, it was very clear to us that by examining George Floyd's life, we can show how institutional racism works in the 21st century. It's not something that we see in, you know, whites-only signs or burning crosses or the things we saw 60, 70 years ago, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening, and it's harder to see, yeah. But we wanted to explore it through George Floyd's life.
Well, and you're exploring it in a, you know, his life ends in a state that's known for being nice. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to understand the way that black folks in Minnesota see their state. When I was president of the NAACP during the recession, towards the end, I was going there. We were dealing with the Trayvon Martin case then, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But I remember going through the employment stats. And at the end of the recession, there were only two states in America where a black person, regardless level of education, was three times as likely to be unemployed as a white person at the same level of education. It was Mississippi and Minnesota.
Right.
Tell us about your kind of diving into a state known for being nice.
Well, one of the questions that we had was how this could be, right? When you think about Minnesota, you think about Hubert Humphrey and the legacy of progressive policy. And a part of that is why George Floyd left Houston for Minnesota. He wanted to go to a place where, even though he had an arrest record, he could have more opportunity. You couldn't even become a barber in Texas if you had a felony like George Floyd had. But when he gets there, he encounters a different sort of situation, right? And when you look at the statistics from unemployment, like you mentioned, to median income, to education, Minnesota stands out as being one of the most prosperous states if you're white. But if you're black, that gap, that disparity, is one of the largest you'll see throughout the entire country. Now, how could this be? Well, when you speak with people who've studied this, and what we talk about in the book, is that they believed in doing the best for the best number of people, the greatest good for the greatest number of people, which means if you're not in that position, if you're marginalized, your politicians, your lawmakers aren't looking out for you. And ultimately, this is a story about a man who is navigating a lot of systems, whose ancestors navigated a lot of systems, and their humanity was never fully seen. And that happens in conservative places, and that happens in progressive places as well.
What surprised you? You dig into this man's life, you dig into, again, you know, Minnesota, which is in some ways, you know, like Mississippi, a bit of a closed society. What surprised you?
There was a lot in this book that we learned over the course of more than 400 interviews, and a lot of it was surprising in trying to understand George Floyd. You can look at someone on a 10-minute video that happens to capture the worst of their life, the last moments of their life, and think you know them, but there was a lot that we learned. And one of the things that was surprising to me was digging back into George Floyd's family history. This book covers seven generations of his family, and it traces his family back to the late 1800s, including his great-great-grandfather. I was surprised to learn that George Floyd had a history of great wealth in his family history. His great-great-grandfather was born enslaved in the mid-1800s, and he worked hard after receiving his freedom after the Civil War and amassed 500 acres of land in eastern North Carolina as a black man. That was something that was almost unheard of and made him one of the wealthiest men in his community. And unfortunately, that attracted the attention of white people who didn't like the fact that there was a wealthy black man in their community, a wealthy black farmer, and they seized all of his land through fraudulent tax sales and unscrupulous business deals. Yeah. And that led to generational poverty in the lead up to George Floyd coming into the world His other ancestors worked incredibly hard, but they were sharecroppers and they couldn't pass down any wealth. So he comes into the world poor, despite the fact that his ancestors had worked hard and had pursued the American dream. And it was surprising to learn about that and to do the research and to find the property deeds and all the records that the family knew through sort of this family lore, but to substantiate it and see that this was a real story, this is a real part of his American journey and the American journey of his family was incredibly surprising to find, and it was important for us to put that in the book because people say slavery was such a long time ago, but we see the real impact on George Floyd's life, why he came into the world poor despite having a long history of family that worked really hard in this country.
Well, and faced challenges despite, like, what did you find out about George as a young person?
Right. I think for me, one of the most surprising things was learning about George Floyd himself. We had heard at the beginning of this that there was a rumor that George Floyd had wanted to be a Supreme Court justice growing up. And you think that's interesting, right? But when we started to do the reporting, we learned there was so much more in the story. How did George Floyd come up with the idea of being a Supreme Court justice? He wasn't thinking about it in the same way that you'd want to be a fireman or a professional wrestler, which is what I wanted to be when I was growing up. He was taught about Thurgood Marshall.
I'm sorry, I just had an image of you as a wrestler.
I still have them. He was taught about Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
And in his second grade class, his teacher had them write essays about who they wanted to be. And when we saw the essay, it's in second grade, so it's not very long, but he talks about wanting to keep order, wanting to send bad people to jail, but also the words were spelled right, the grammar was fine, the punctuation was fine, and it turned out that at second grade, George Floyd, who had grown up in an under-resourced, impoverished community,
public housing project,
right, was reading at grade level, which is very hard in this country to do. You know that.
Yeah.
So the question...
Well, and they say, I mean, it's a bit of an urban legend, but there is still some logical correlation that children who struggle to read by the third grade are sort of accelerating towards prison, right? So here's a child who could read well at the second grade.
Right.
Maybe he was accelerating at that point towards the Supreme Court.
Right. Fourth grade is often seen as the turning point, right? Yeah. And so he had it. He was doing... There was something special and unique about what he was doing. And that
resonates. Yeah. We were talking backstage. You know, one of the interesting things about George, you know, so many black men killed. And I had never heard a black celebrity say, I knew him. And I'm with Dave Chappelle, and he says, I knew him. I knew him as a security guard. He was down in Houston. He stood out. So here's a guy who was standing out as a human being in the second grade. And, you know, when you're a celebrity, you meet lots of security people. You don't remember most of their names. But Dave Chappelle remembered him clearly and mentioned other celebrities who also remembered him. So he was a standout person in some ways. So what went wrong, and why was he in Minnesota when he had grown up in Houston?
And what you mentioned about Dave Chappelle is really interesting, because George Floyd actually intersected with a lot of celebrities, and there were a lot of people who ended up knowing him and remembering him. And the first lines of this book include the quote, I love you, and we talk about how George Floyd would go around saying I love you to people that he knew, people he didn't know, big-time celebrities, homeless people on the street. He would just go around saying I love you. That was part of his personality. And unfortunately, in the last moments of his life, he was screaming out, I love you, tell my kids I love them. Mm. He was saying I love you to his mother as well as he was breathing his last breath. And that's part of the reason why he was so memorable. People remembered him, and he had a major stature in Houston. He was somebody who was well known in his community in Third Ward. He was somebody who people looked up to. He was somebody who was seen as a hood diplomat, in the words of one of his friends. He could go to any neighborhood and try to tell other people to put the guns away, to squash beefs and whatnot, because he had that level of respect in the community.
Credibility.
He had credibility, but he also hit rock bottom in Houston because he had a record, and he realized that, as Robert said, he couldn't even get a job as a barber. Texas is not a very forgiving state. It's not a place where you can get a lot of resources. It had not expanded Medicaid, and it was a place that was difficult for him to provide for his family. He had a daughter at the time, and he realized that his life was going in the wrong direction. So he decided to go to a pastor. That pastor said, if you want to get on the right track, you need to leave Texas, let Houston take care of itself, leave your family behind, and separate yourself from what you know, but work on yourself. Go to a rehab program. And there's a program in Minneapolis that had a track record of taking people out of Houston, helping them get their lives on track, and then letting them go back to Houston much more stable with jobs, with training, with skills that they could use. And that was his plan. He wanted to go get himself together for some time and then come back to Houston. That's why he left Houston for Minneapolis, because he wanted to get into rehab, to get clean, to get a job, to get stable, to get health care, and get himself together. And he did that in 2017, thinking that he'd be able to come back to Houston and take care of his child. But unfortunately, we all know that he never made it out of Minneapolis.
This book is about George Floyd. It's about his America. Both you guys, your parents are immigrants, right? From Jamaica, from Nigeria. We're going through a time in this country, right, where the right wing pushing this great replacement theory, they're pushing this phrase, legacy Americans. My family, both sides, have been here for 400 years. I don't know if it includes me or not, the way I say it. You know, we send from Thomas Jefferson's grandma, but by the other grandchildren, I don't know if it's in the white supremacist worldview. I want to get to what you figured out about George Floyd's America, but what did you figure out about our America writing this? What did you figure out about what we're starting to sort of, shape to leave for our children? Like, what did you figure out about our America writing this book?
Well, one of the interviews that we have that closes the book is our discussion with the Reverend Jesse Jackson about this. And he talks about the pleasure and the pain of the Black experience in America. And he posits that we should look at the long arc of history to note how far we've come as a country. And you don't have to look too far into the present. You can look to last week to note the pain that comes with America. When we think about George Floyd, I talked earlier about one of the greatest surprises was learning about George Floyd himself. We were really nervous that we'd produce a book that was just a story about pain. George Floyd, however, really believed in the promise of the United States.
Yeah.
And he continued to think that despite all that happened, he'd be able to live a good life and to be able to provide for his children. And that spirit was also carried out with the number of people who took up his cause after he died. And so when I consider what we've learned about America over this, right, there's the pleasure, there's the pain, and there's also the persistence. And that's the persistence that starts with George Floyd's story, but it's also picked up by people in the last part of the book when they start to push for something that's better than we have today.
That was really eloquently said, and I wanted to also...
I heard he's a good writer.
not bad. It was...
I've done something. And for
people listening, I want everyone to know that Robert and I are journalists, and we bring a level of empathy to this story, to the story about George Floyd's America. But we also were in search of the truth, and the truth sometimes took us to dark places, because George Floyd in his life had some dark moments. And we don't shy away from those moments. He didn't shy away from them. In his diary entries, in his letters, in his text messages to his friends, he talked about the agony that he felt. He talked about the regret he felt over some of the decisions that he made, over some of the places that he ended up going into. So this book includes a chapter called The State of Texas versus George Floyd, which goes into George Floyd's time in the criminal justice system. He signed his name to the bottom of several guilty pleas on documents that started with The State of Texas versus George Floyd. And he felt like if that was the matchup, a man versus a state, a man that didn't have a lawyer, a man that didn't have very many resources, that he had to concede and plead guilty. In some cases, he admitted to his friends that he was guilty. In some cases, he said he was not guilty. And even in those cases, his friends said, you have to plead guilty, because if you go to trial, you're going to get convicted and you're going to spend much more time in jail than if you take this plea deal. So it was important for us to go into all of those areas, to research his history, his record, to show what made America for George Floyd the kind of country that it was, and the country that we all embrace, as a country that we're responsible for. It's a country that we have a responsibility to make better, and we need to grapple with some of the issues in this book, some of the institutions that we explain in this book, the criminal justice system that, you know, disproportionately targeted people like George Floyd for sometimes doing things that are done on college campuses or in wealthy communities that don't receive the same level of punishment and incarceration as George Floyd's community faced. So, you know, George Floyd's America is our America, and it's important for us to all recognize that we all hold a responsibility to not leave that version of the country behind.
I started out my career as a reporter in Jackson, Mississippi, covering police corruption. And I carry scars from things I learned about what this country can do to people and hell holes that exist throughout Mississippi. What did this book do to you? How did writing this book change each of you?
I'll tell you a little story, maybe longer than a little. One thing that I hope people remember is a lot of the reporting that happened for this book occurred before there was a criminal trial for Derek Chauvin.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had been spending time with the Floyd family and with people who had known George Floyd as they were watching this trial, this great American trial unfurl, not knowing what was going to happen.
Right.
One day, one Sunday, I was out with Philonis, one of George Floyd's brothers, and we go to church, and there's a breakdown in the church. And then I left Philonis because he was going to go buy a suit because he was about to testify, either the next day or the following. And I met up with Courtney Ross, who was George Floyd's girlfriend in Minneapolis. She had really secluded herself during the trial because she was afraid she was going to cause a mistrial because they both went through drug dependency together. So Courtney has decided she's going to support another woman named Tashira Garraway, who's also lost her boyfriend through dubious practices. She's having a rally for him. Courtney goes to support her at the rally. When we get to the strip mall where the rally is happening, Courtney calls and she's having a panic attack. That's how the story starts. Yeah. We're at the rally and we see all these mothers, daughters, sons, boyfriends, girlfriends, and they've all lost their loved ones to police violence under dubious practices, in the same way George Floyd was lost. Unfortunately, they had no cameras. They had no one to take up that cause. And already I'm feeling overwhelmed. As the rally happens, someone gets a text message and says, they've killed another one. And it's a 20-year-old named Dante Wright, who was shot and killed by a police officer who mistook her gun for her taser. Turns out.
But in the context of a police department, that the state AFL-CIO referred to their union, right? So the state confederation of unions refers to the local Minneapolis police union as a white supremacist organization.
Yeah, well, we know that now. Right. We know that now. Turns out Dante was a former student of Courtney Ross. And the killing happens a few miles away from where Philonis is buying his suit. When that's happening all around you, it really changes the way you think about race and racism in this country and how it's carried out. You know, we've talked about it as the original sin, the stain on the fabric of the American experience. But what I saw was the lingering residue encircling around people. It started to feel like a force.
Yeah.
And knowing that, right? Knowing that it made me understand why people were out marching in a different kind of way, because it felt like if this force was not confronted and acknowledged, it would consume you. And if it wouldn't consume you, it would corrupt you. And so,
if it didn't corrupt you, it might kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so when I think about all of this, for me, it deepened my resolve in terms of what we do as journalists, right? People join with us to tell stories. And they tell stories because they believe that in telling a story, some good might be unlocked in the world. And so when I think about this entire experience, you know, Tolu and I, we've sat with people who have a lot of ghosts, a lot of demons, a lot of unresolved trauma. And you take some of that, but you also take the deepening of the mission about what you're doing. And that's what we try to pour into this book.
Yeah, there is a lot of pain involved in the process of turning George Floyd's life into a book. I talked earlier about how I had not wanted to watch the video when it first came out. But in this book, in one of the chapters, we had to recreate the scene of his death, which involved not only watching the video once, but really engaging with it, sitting with it, watching it over and over, creating the dialogue, seeing what people said, seeing all the times that the police could have acted in a different way that may have spared someone's life, and they didn't, all the decisions that went into his death. And that was traumatic to do and experience, and to watch George Floyd die, you know, dozens of times over and over again in order to write it for this book. But one of the things we do in that chapter is that we flash back. We go away from the scene of his heinous death to flash back to some lighter moments in his life where he's experiencing life as a normal person. And the interviews that we did allowed us to experience some of that, understanding who Floyd was, understanding the impact that he had on people, the memories that people had, and that brought some levity to what could have been a very painful experience. And it was important for us to show his full humanity, the light moments, the times where he made people laugh, the times where he was ambitious and had dreams, the times where he was, you know, just enjoying life, you know, enjoying his experience. And we wanted to make sure that was reflected as well, because like Robert said, we don't want this to be an exercise just in pain. We wanted people to know that he was a full person that had his strong points, his high points, his good times. He had his low points as well, and his times in the darkness. But that was one of the things that helped to know George Floyd, to know that despite all of the barriers that he faced, all of the things that were thrown at him, all of the challenges that he faced, having, and in the words of his mother, two strikes against him from birth, he continued to strive, he continued to fight. He picked up and moved from Houston to Minneapolis to try to reset his life. And knowing that, and knowing how hard he worked and how hard he strived in this country was inspirational. And it made me realize that I also owe it to this country to not give up, to not allow the pain and the hardship of, you know, knowing George Floyd's story to be an excuse to give up. He continued to strive. The people that took up his cause have continued to believe in this country and to believe it could be a place where things can be better. And, you know, as journalists, we have a responsibility as well, even though we're not policymakers. We have a responsibility to shine a light on injustice so people can make decisions and move forward and move this country forward in a positive way. So even with the pain that was involved in researching George Floyd's life, it was important for there to be that resolve that Robert talked about as well.
2 minutes ago, they said we have about 5 minutes for me to finish. So I'm going to ask each of you the same question to answer. You know, right, you're Washington Post reporters. That's a big deal. That's an achievement. It is a unique institution in our country. It is perhaps the newspaper that believes most that government can be a force for good. It has also been a newspaper, the Pentagon Papers, for example, that when government has failed, has been unafraid to tell the hard truth about failure of government. It's a newspaper that believes that there is an objective truth to be told, to be reckoned with. What's the objective truth about George Floyd and his America that you want your readers to walk away understanding? I'd love to hear each of you answer that question.
I'll try to summarize it in three sentences. George Floyd believed in this country. this country didn't always believe in George Floyd. There's something that we could do to make sure other people like George Floyd can have that sense of belief and fullness that he did not get.
And I'll keep my answer relatively brief as well. You know, the Washington Post has a motto, democracy dies in darkness. And as we wrote this book, we realized that not only democracy dies in darkness, but justice and equality die in darkness. And that darkness sometimes exists in the fact that we don't spend as much time focusing on communities like the one where George Floyd lived. And it's incumbent on us as journalists and as the media to make sure that those stories get told, that before George Floyd meets a Derek Chauvin, that people know what it's like for someone like him. And it's not only when he dies on camera and when someone, you know, dies in such a heinous way and there's a big outcry that we cover it, but we cover the time that he spent slowly dying in America under harsh institutions. It's important for us in our role to make sure that we do that.
Thank you both for writing this book.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, now's the fun part. We get to pull you guys into this conversation. I believe there's somebody moving around with a microphone. Let's start here in the front, and then we will take it from there.
Thank you. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thanks.
This is a very short two-part. One, there's been a trend of folks like Candace Owens and Glenn Lowry and my cousin John McWhorter, who have kind of demonized some of the folks like George and Trayvon and Brother Brown from Ferguson. What's your take on that? And the second quick question was, as the son, children of immigrants, what's your kind of take from your family, either here or over there? What's your take on how what's their take on and their understanding of what goes on here? Thank you.
Yeah. I'll start. The trope of criminalizing and making black people, particularly black men, seem heinous has gone on long before Candace Owens. She's inheriting a trope, right? And that is this belief that had been based on junk science that somehow black people, when they're upset, will gather superhuman strength, that they'll be able to do ridiculous things, and that they should be blamed, right, for anything that does not fall into the mainstream of what we believe, what the mainstream actions. What we know, and we talk about this in the book, right, is that there are various ways of thinking about the American experience, and there's a truth, right, that when you put someone's lives in the context of their experience, in the context of their history, that you'll be able to see things, and you'll be able to see them fuller. So those... Racism, the vestiges of systemic racism just don't lie within white people, right?
You know, somebody put that well once, you know, racism in America is like soot in Pittsburgh in the 1950s. There was no way to walk through Pittsburgh without soot ending up in your lungs, and there's no way to walk through America without racism sticking in your brain. Yeah. You test people's implicit bias, and it really isn't determined by what they look like. I would distinguish your cousin in his defense from the other two. McWhorter has been courageous in saying that American drug laws, if you want to see black America as it was in the 1940s, get rid of our drug laws and you'll see it revert back, which is pretty courageous for a black conservative.
And I can answer your second question a little bit. My parents have engaged with this book, and I didn't share it with them before it was published, but they're reading it now, and they felt that they learned a lot about the black American experience that they didn't know before, having grown up in Nigeria. And it's something my dad taught at an HBCU, and he spent a lot of time doing some of the research, but he felt that this book took him deeper and helped him get a better understanding. And that's the kind of empathy that we want people to get from this book. I think, you know, reading this book, they understood more, you know, some of the troubles and trials that people who had been in this country for generations have experienced, and why it can be harder for people who have, you know, like George Floyd had, a history of abuse in this country to, you know, believe in the American experience and the American promise as easily as it is for an immigrant who came here by choice and who, you know, may not have that level of trauma from this country. So it helped him to understand it, and that was something that was very helpful to hear, that that was something that they took from reading this book.
I, as a fifth generation American, I'm a native Texan. I lived in Houston for a few years, unfortunately never ran across George Floyd. I feel this country, I think about my mom's mom. She was born in like 1907, and she was a maid all her life. And from what I hear from the family, she worked like 5 days a week or 6 days a week, and she ended up with $5. But she still managed to buy a home. This is before the housing in the 60s in Texas, before the housing market just exploded, and I guess, you know, people got so greedy. I feel like this country, it got rid of the people in power, got rid of the Native Americans. It practiced genocide on them. I guess they were reduced to from millions to like maybe 100,000, 200, whatever, on the reservation. So that was genocide. I feel like genocide is being practiced on my people, African Americans. It's just slow motion, more slow motion.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is definitely, I feel it is genocide.
Well, there's a, in our generation, I'm assuming you're Gen X, perhaps you're Gen Y, but certainly, you know, there are 1.5 million missing black men, like, who should be here alive, but because of incarceration and...
mass incarceration.
Yeah, aren't here. And that has a massive impact in our community. You can go to an... Your father was at FAMU, or... And I remember being a student at Jackson State, you know, and up at Columbia, where I'd been a student, you know, black women, black men were like 1-to-1. But in Jackson State, it was 1-to-6. It was one brother on campus every 6 women on campus. And it was the inverse. What you were seeing was the reflection of mass incarceration. The was there a question, or was it a statement about genocide?
I had another point. I look at Tulsa, Oklahoma, which was called Black Wall Street.
Yep.
It's a situation where the whites don't want the blacks near them or in their community, so they go far away and they have a successful community, and it's still bombed. It's like either you be a slave, you be a type of Clarence Thomas figure that's basically a puppet.
Yep.
If you have dignity, if you have pride, if you want
to
assert your rights, you're the enemy of the state. And it's almost a no-win situation. About 10 years ago, I asked my ex-husband, I said, let's move to Canada. And he waved the flag and said, no way. And I was fearful about doing it in my 50s by myself, so I didn't. This was before Trump. I was ready to go. And Stevie Wonder left.
Yeah.
I wish I had his finances. I'd probably be in Ghana right now.
Yeah, Stevie Wonder's still in L.A. a lot.
But he's in Ghana.
Yeah, no, he did. He did for a while.
Well, one of the things I do want to point out to you, especially as someone who had spent time in Houston, is when you look at, there was a question earlier about how a person who had the aspiration in second grade of being a Supreme Court justice ends up in the situation like George Floyd has. And we talk about it in the book in terms of what happened when the courts mandated integration of the Texas school district, of the school district in Houston, which was one of the last ones to integrate. And there is something very specific that happens with the white community there, and all that stuff has a direct impact on the type of education that George Floyd gets, and also his ambitions when they see that he's tall and fast and they put a football in front of him instead of a calculus textbook.
100%. But also, you know, there's an interesting thing there. You know, you're talking about Tulsa, and you talked about the land loss, right? Now, in the modern era, if you will, a black land loss that was from World War II to the end of the Cold War, black folks in America lost 500 to 1,000 acres per day, every day, every year. Partition sales, tax. But what you were talking about was actually much earlier and was in the midst of really the reign of terror of the Ku Klux Klan, the wake of the Hayes-Tilden Compromise. And I've recently dug into that era in the neighboring state of Virginia, my family's own experience. One of the things that kind of blew me away was that the Klan was really financed by the plantation class and the owning class, and they were upset about the market share that black business people had gained in places like Richmond coming out of slavery, and how industrious people like George Floyd's ancestor, you know, Estate South, were. And that there were whites who actually fought alongside them for a time in the early 1880s, the era of the land-grant schools and all of that. When you think about that, what do you think that the impact was of losing those 500 acres, of having the first generation out of slavery's aspirations assaulted so thoroughly and their legacy that they were building for their family destroyed?
It's unmistakable. We spoke to George Floyd's aunts. We spoke to people who lived as sharecroppers as a result of the fact that their grandfather had lived in great wealth and lost that great wealth before he could pass the money down. And that oral history, that story had passed down, and it continued to be a sting. It continued to be something they talked about like it happened yesterday, because they spent days as children working on tobacco farms as sharecroppers when they could have been the heirs to a great fortune. And it was something that they talked about with great regret, and they talked about how hard they had to work.
But also a sense of weight, right?
Like, oh,
a
definitely.
Sense of like, yeah. you can earn, you know, you can basically accumulate all the wealth, but they can take it away from you, right? That's part of...
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And what does that do to your belief in the American dream, your belief in the fact that you can work hard and pass something down to your children? And yeah, that was a cautionary tale that got passed down to George Floyd. And he knew about his ancestor. He knew about how his ancestor had suffered from racism. And he knew that he was born in poverty because of that. And he was aware of the fact that any mistake that he made, any decision that...
You get others, one chance.
One chance, and everything can be taken away. And he knew that. He realized that. His mother taught him that. And that was something that from a young age he had to live with.
And I think one of the things that it's important to know, to put a point on this, is that when we were talking about the history of sharecropping and the abusive nature of it, these were not people in their 90s. Gen X, generation before, those were the people. That's how long that history goes.
You talked about George Floyd's America. I'm just wondering in your research how you saw Derek Chauvin's America and how they collided.
And if you could also, what did you learn about the relationship between the two? Because we learned through the media at the time that they had known each other in different places.
Right. Well, there was this rumor that the two had known each other. And we looked into it. State's attorney's office looked into it. We spoke to people who are feeding that rumor, but there's no actual documentation of it. There's no reason to believe that George Floyd and Derek Chauvin knew each other. There is reason to believe why Derek Chauvin thought he could put his knee on his neck on Derek Chauvin, even if he didn't know him. And I think that gets to the heart of your question. So what we tried to contact more than 100 people, and we also did, who had known Derek Chauvin. Many of them spoke, none on the record. And we also looked into his family history. We know that his ancestors came to the United States on a boat from Germany and France freely. They were able to work as migrants and do trades and work in domestic works, much like George Floyd's family. They got paid for it. They were able to build wealth. Eventually land in the Minneapolis suburbs, where George Floyd was, as people could tell, was an average student who loved watching Starsky and Hutch, which I did not know about Starsky and Hutch, and might lead someone to want to be a police officer.
It was a good show.
I mean, it's not my thing.
As a latchkey Gen Xer, it was a good show.
Yeah. So Derek Chauvin decides he wants to become a police officer, and he becomes a police officer in a precinct called the Third Precinct that has a pretty diverse swath. That precinct, specifically, is known for having officers that use more force than they should. That's the words of the person who was running the precinct. That's what she told us, not some watchdog. That was her interpretation of what was happening there. We go into the book why the officers think they could do that, which has to do with the history of the war on drugs. But Derek Chauvin, 18 days after he is taught about a type of restraint that they want to train officers on, that's the neck restraint, which can be used in very different ways. But it really is trying to suffocate someone until they stop resisting. And it's used as a way to ensure that you would not kill a suspect. So how does Derek Chauvin do this? Well, 18 days after he starts using this technique, he continues to use it over time. People complain about him being an aggressive officer, which is not unusual in that district. And those who oversee Derek Chauvin never do anything more than a slap on the wrist. So you have a police department with a history of aggressive actions where the officers are acting with impunity. No one's touching them. We also know that in a number of those incidents, and we were able to track at least 9 incidents in which Derek Chauvin uses a neck restraint, that the most common reason he gave was that the person was bigger than he was.
Mm.
So,
question. Did you figure out whether he was a bully or he was bullied when he was in school?
There's no discussion about that from people we know. What we know is Derek Chauvin, he was the son of divorced parents. By the accounts that we received from people who knew him growing up, he was a pretty typical child. There are folks who suspect he might have been bullied or things like that. But, you know, when we spoke with Keith Ellison, who really wanted to figure out the psychology of Derek Chauvin, because then he'd be able to charge him with a higher crime, he said at some point we needed to give up trying to learn about him, because the action itself was predicated on a system that used excessive force within that community. So the question that we think of when we talk about systems, right, and how people operate in that, systemic racism, like I said, doesn't affect just black people. Derek Chauvin was also trained in a world that had an institutional bias against a certain type of people, and he executed that. It shaped his life in the way, not in the same way, but it shaped his life as it shaped George Floyd's life.
Watching the two of you, and I'm thinking about this, it's hard to dig into a case like this for a year. It's hard to cover it for a day. The role of a reporter in our society is to be a translator of sorts, right? You don't just dig into George Floyd's life. You know, you dig into Derek Chauvin's life, right? You don't just look for the good in George or the bad in Derek. You look for the good and the bad in the each, and you try to tell that story. Early in my career, I worked with Desmond Tutu during the time that he was leading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We were working trying to keep a young South African off death row in Mississippi. And I was with him on a day when he had just gotten news that the translators, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, were losing their minds. Because they were literally translating for the person who tortured and the person who was tortured. And in South Africa, translators have to know 5 languages, so they were going back and forth. And he said he had provided for the mental health of everybody in the TRC except for the translators. How do you maintain your resilience as translators in our society? What did you have to figure out in this process, you know, to not lose your mind?
Yeah, that anecdote is really powerful, because there are people that are involved in the process, journalists being one of them, that are often kind of seen as just doing their jobs. Their job is to be unemotional. Their job is just to present the facts and move on. But You know, the facts can sometimes be painful, and, you know, Robert wrote in a Outlook piece for the Washington Post over the weekend that, you know, our job as journalists is not to make the story about us, but George Floyd, and the story that we were writing was about the black male experience in America. In some ways, that means it was about us, and it was important for us to be a step removed from the story in order to be able to tell it without being overly emotional or being consumed by it. But, you know, we're human beings, we're not robots. So there was, you know, an impact. I talked about having to watch George Floyd die over and over again. That was part of it. And one of the things that we do was, you know, we rely on each other. We spend a lot of time talking and texting and just trying to find light moments in this process, as well as, you know, checking on each other and making sure that we're doing okay through the process. And knowing that we have a sense of responsibility, knowing that there's a greater mission, knowing that as people read this book, like I talked about my parents, and they felt like they learned something, they were changed by it, that was, you know, heartening, in addition to, you know, making sure we're getting good health care and good mental health, just knowing that there is a greater good, hopefully, that is coming out of this book, that people are engaging with it, that's helpful. That's something that we can look at, because, you know, there's always going to be backlash, there's always going to be, you know, we've dealt with white supremacists that have come after us because of what we've written and whatnot, so there's...
Well, I mean, you put Ibrahim X. Kendi on the front of the book.
Right.
There will be more.
We knew what we were signing up for. We knew it was going to be tough. Sometimes we were surprised by some of the things that we heard. But knowing that we have a greater mission, knowing that people will be moved by this book, knowing that this is a work of history and that we're writing for history, helps us to look at this at a deeper level and look at the broader mission that we're behind.
And I'd also just like to add that there was an interviewer who said to Tolu the other day, this book is for white people, isn't it? You know, yes, and it's for black people and everyone else. And the reason why is that I don't think of us as just translators. We were learning about something ourselves. Like, we were learning about not just this family, but a deeper history and a deeper appreciation of the research and the lack of research that centers around the black experience in America. One of the things I'll tell you that really struck me that I can't get over is in 2010, that might not be the exact year, there was a study done by the National Institutes of Health that said, we have only done 19 studies looking at depression in black men specifically. They called it a crisis, an urgent need that needed to be funded. As we're writing this book, it came out in Science magazine that black researchers were not being able to secure the funding that would facilitate that sort of research, right? And so there's this unknown territory of what we don't know. So it wasn't just translating it for someone else. It was the process of being able to learn about this country in a way and learn it along with people. When I was with Ben Crump and the family, when they said, we're going to Washington in a month, Joe Biden, our friend Joe, who just called, is going to sign this bill for federal police reform. It's been 2 years. We saw an executive action that's a limited function of it today, but that hasn't happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we were learning about this too.
Thank you both. You know, we've been told that it's time. I just want to offer as a final thought to the audience. You know, we are on a journey as a nation, this city, where I'm a professor at Penn, played a big role. Our country is probably set up to kind of lose its mind over the next quarter century because white people are becoming a minority too. And yet, I think it's reasonable for us to have hope that we will get to the place that Frederick Douglass said we are destined to become. He said that every nation's character is based, that every nation has a destiny. Its destiny is based on its character. Its character, he reasoned, was shaped by its geography, that our geography is world connected. Great nations north and south of us, defined by different races, great oceans east and west of us that connect us to every people on the planet. And Frederick Douglass then said, and I've been paraphrasing because he's a 19th century orator, that our destiny, based on our geography and defined ultimately by our character at our best, is to be, quote, the most perfect example of the unity and dignity of the human family that the world has ever known. Your journalism, this book, I think, helps us move towards that goal. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.